Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Today is the day before Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it's an eventful day as well. In the Middle East, news stories tell us that Israel has told Hamas to accept ceasefire terms or risk a new onslaught in the near future. We're also told that the main border crossing to Gaza for aid relief has been closed. Hamas is also claiming responsibility for an attack at a border crossing between Israel and Gaza. And the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, killed Hamas gunmen overnight near the community of Jokam, I understand. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Joining us on the program to speak about all of this and specifically to the issue of Holocaust Remembrance Day tomorrow is Israel's ambassador to Canada, Ambassador Ido Moed. Ambassador Moed, thank you very much for the time. How are you?
Thank you for having me, Roy. I'm okay. Very concerned and sad. You know, this is, as you said, the eve of Holocaust Remembrance Day, so this is always a sad day for all of us.
I wonder actually how many people even knew that it was Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it's important that we know this, but we've fallen out of the habit of really speaking about these truly important issues, and even addressing history, the history of this country. But let me ask you about these news stories about today, with Israel telling Hamas to accept the ceasefire terms or risk a new onslaught in the near future, the main border crossing to Gaza for aid relief has been closed, Hamas claiming responsibility for an attack on a border crossing between Israel and Gaza, with Israeli casualties, and IDF killing Hamas gunmen overnight. These are all developments that it doesn't look like it's going to be leading to a ceasefire anytime soon, Ambassador.
I think that we have to take this day very seriously, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, which starts tonight, because it has, for us, a very significant meaning when we are talking about developments in our region. We see hate marches on the streets here, which remind many people of things that happened more than 80 years ago in Europe. We hear calls for annihilation of the state of Israel here on the streets. We see blatant anti-Semitism against Canadians. And we see that an organization like Samedun, which is directly connected and linked with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a terrorist organization also listed as such here in Canada, that they are inciting the population and they are calling for their annihilation. They are celebrating the massacre. They are glorifying the terrorists. They are not gunmen. They are pure terrorists. And so I think that it is something that we need to keep in our minds when we are marking this day. Israeli law prescribes that we mark Holocaust Remembrance Day not just because we want to remember the victims. You know, both my parents survived the Holocaust, and I have many family members who perished in the Holocaust. But it's not only that. It's because we want to look forward, and we say, never again. And to people in Israel, some people say perhaps we failed if we had to endure this massacre of 1,200 people. I don't think so. We see that the same genocidal intent is there, but we are much stronger. We have an independent state, and we are able to protect ourselves. So when we are looking at what is happening around us, the fact that 132 hostages are being held in those tunnels underneath Rafah or wherever, by this genocidal terrorist organization. And we see that in other parts, like on the West Bank, terrorists attack Israel and Israelis. We know that we have to fight back and we have to stand strong against those attacks, just as we have to stand strong here in Canada against those who rise and call for annihilation. So it's a time that connects what happened 80 years ago with today. And that day, that special day, that Holocaust Remembrance Day is extremely relevant today.
Is it your sense, is it your government's sense that Israel is facing an existential threat to its very existence at this particular time?
We feel, many Israelis feel, that the culmination of the proxies that Iran established and constructed around Israel, the Hamas, the Hezbollah that holds 170,000 precision-guided missiles aimed at all over Israel, the Houthis in Yemen that thwart international trade and actually one of the main global trade routes, in Iraq, in Syria, and elsewhere, we see that there is indeed that threat to annihilate the state of Israel, which is also stated time and again by the Iranian leadership. So in that sense, it's an existential threat because it's a direct call for the annihilation of our nation. And so in that sense, but we are, of course, very strong and we are resilient and we will overcome this. There is no doubt about that. So we think that it is existential because they come out and say openly, we want to kill all Jews. We want to annihilate the state of Israel. And so we have to make sure that first and foremost, that doesn't happen, but also that the world realizes that it is not just a fight for Israel and Israelis and Jews. It's actually a fight about values, the very basic values that we all hold, of tolerance and understanding and coexistence, which are very prevalent in Israel, by the way. And you ask many Israeli Arabs, they feel very comfortable in Israel, and they are part of those who fight against Hamas because they know that they definitely don't want to have any kind of Hamas rule. So those values are now under stress, under pressure, under attack, and therefore we all must rise against that and do whatever we can because this is a sort of a wave, a tidal wave that is rising that has to be it has to be fought against and has to be mitigated. We have to overcome it, all of us together.
Yeah, I was about to suggest it's a battle on many fronts, but I think the tidal wave metaphor is far better than that. Can we just bring it back to what's happening in this country? Because I'd like your thoughts on the demonstrations and the occupations at Canadian universities, because tomorrow, on Holocaust Remembrance Day, in this country, there will be calls for genocide of Jews in Canada. There will be calls for genocide of fellow citizens, of these demonstrators. I'm not sure what to call them. But there will be calls for genocide of Canadian Jews by fellow Canadians. How do you deal with that? How do you approach that?
I'll tell you. First and foremost, I think I'm very sad to see that so many young people are brainwashed and tend to follow ideas that I don't think they truly believe in. Because when we see these hate marches and hate manifestations, they are pure venom. And everybody who is on it can easily understand and see that. We have to look at the source. And in my mind, one of the leading sources is this Samidum, which is so-called Organization for the Welfare of Palestinian Prisoners. But actually, as you've seen, this lady, Kate, yelling on the stairs of the Art Center in Vancouver, glorifying and calling the terrorist acts brave, I think that this is what people, young people, many people don't understand. There is zero tolerance for those who are not adhering exactly to the line of Hamas, which is a fundamentalist, genocidal terror organization. And people don't understand when they support it. They think that they are calling for the cause of Palestinians. But it has nothing to do with the Palestinian cause because Palestinians are suffering under the hands of Hamas. Look what's happening in Gaza. For 18 years, there's been no one Israeli soldier there. It's been free of any kind of what they would call occupation. And what has Hamas done for the population? Nothing. If you just look at the billions of dollars that have flown into the Gaza Strip, they've gone underground, not for water pipes, to improve the water quality, because death mortality among children until very recently has been extremely high, because all of it went to the tunnels of Hamas, not for the sake of the population. no schools, no employment, no industry, no economy, nothing whatsoever, only this fundamentalist genocide organization that was preparing a war machine to attack and kill as many Israelis as possible. So if people want to support Palestinians, that's definitely not Hamas.
Ambassador Moed, I'm sure you've heard the audio of New York City Mayor Eric Adams just shortly after October the 7th. I listened to it this morning, and I thought it would be, because so much of the quest for a ceasefire centers around Hamas' return of hostages, I thought it would be perhaps useful, helpful, appropriate to listen to 1 minute of what the mayor had to say. Please listen.
We are not all right when we see young girls pulled from their home and dragged through the streets. We are not all right when we see grandmothers being pulled away from their homes and children shot in front of their families. We are not all right when right here in the city of New York, you have those who celebrate at the same time when the devastation is taking place in our city. We are not all right when Hamas believes that they are fighting on behalf of something in their destructive, despicable action that carried out. We are not all right when we still have hostages who have not come home to their family. We are not all right. And we're not going to say we have a stiff upper lip and act like everything is fine. Everything is not fine. Israel has a right to defend himself, and that's the right that we know. Your fight is our fight. Your fight is our fight.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams. And I thought it was useful to have a listen to what the mayor had to say, because, again, Ambassador, so much of what's going on now and the quest for a ceasefire centers around Hamas releasing Israeli hostages.
Yes. They're very strong words, and it is spoken from deep in his heart because of the belief that this cannot be tolerated. Hamas is playing this horrific game with the lives of tens of people, where there are 132 hostages being held. We know that more than 30 are, we have pronounced dead, more than 30, and they are still being kept there because Hamas wants to continue and do those, perform those massacres again and again and again. And we will not tolerate that. And so when you look at the families in Israel and you look at people in the eye, everybody on the street will tell you, we have to do everything possible to bring them back. But at the same time, Hamas wants to regain its war machine. They want to rebuild. They want a ceasefire. They want they want guarantees that they will not be attacked personally while they rise to kill us. It's an impossible situation. And so I do hope that very soon, with the help and support of the United States and other countries, we'll get the hostages back. But it's a very complicated situation, very difficult, very emotional.
You know, the Biden administration just recently put on hold an ammunition shipment to Israel. And I want to ask you about this. You talk about looking into the eyes of people, and you look into the eyes of Palestinians, civilians, and the struggle they're facing and the fear they're facing. Now we have the main border crossing to Gaza, border crossing for aid relief closed. Why, Ambassador? That's not going to help.
Well, you have to ask those who shot at the crossing, but I can tell you that I've seen Palestinians from Gaza reacting to it, saying these are collaborators, they're inviting Israel to attack Rafah. I don't know who you know takes in his right mind such a decision, and not to mention the fact of the bravery of Israeli soldiers that they go into harm's way to make sure that the Palestinian population get as much help and humanitarian assistance as possible. But this is indeed this unbelievable situation when we are fighting to protect lives on all sides, Palestinians and Israelis, and we are fighting this monstrous war machine called Hamas that holds back to nothing. So that's why it's so important to understand that this is not just a war of Israel against Hamas. This really goes far beyond that. We want to live in this part of land that we inhabit because our ancestors, Abraham, came to that part of the land. It was promised by God. This is our land. This is where we'll stay forever. But we want to live together with our neighbors, with some we've reached peace agreements. We found wonderful ways to live together with them also inside Israel. There are Supreme Court judges and doctors and everything, but some are out there to kill us. They are not just to kill us. They are out there because they want to annihilate not just the Israel and Jews around the world. Actually, if you look at Iran's long-term strategy and you see that they develop missiles that have reached far beyond Israel, you understand that it doesn't end there. It starts with the Jews. It doesn't end there.
Once again, it's curtains for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And as a listener emailed to me late last night, early morning, he wrote, Leafs now begin the 58th consecutive year of the team rebuild in pursuit of the Stanley Cup. And he continued to express his displeasure by saying Leafs fans equally are, quote, bewildered, are disparaging, and thoroughly off, end of quote. Let's talk to my good friend and colleague, Greg Brady, host of Toronto Today on our Chorus radio station, AM 640, in Toronto, obviously. And Greg, for many years, was a sports broadcaster. We've talked to Greg about sports on this program on a number of occasions. He still broadcasts the NFL for the BBC. So, Greg, I'm sorry, I'm a Habs fan. So the break, the intro was something about Roy supporting Canadians, and it's the Montreal Canadiens. But how do you walk away? How do you come away? How do you, as a sports broadcaster previously, and as a broadcaster, obviously a great broadcaster now, how do you come away from last night? What's your takeaway, and how do you move forward?
I think it's just happened. It's happened so many times in similar fashion that when you're sitting around and it's been, 8 years, especially with this group, for people who don't know, they missed the playoffs from 2000 and when there was a missed season in 2003-04. They missed the playoffs from the spring of 2005 all the way to the spring of 2013. So that's a long time out. And then you're back in, right? You're one of the 16 of 30 or 32 teams, and you get to go to the dance. You get an invitation, and you think there's some randomness to it. Injuries matter. The bounce of the puck matters. But just to keep running into the same wall over and over and over again. And Roy, you remember an era when the Boston Bruins could not beat the Montreal Canadiens. They couldn't beat them in the late 60s and the 70s and for a good chunk of the 80s. And then Boston finally turned the tables on them. This is the fourth game seven that Boston's beaten Toronto since 2013, and it's the third one since 2018, and they've all been in Boston. Like, it just feels like a movie that you know the ending to, and even when Toronto scored last night in the third period, what was it, about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes? They really only had the lead. Like, you can't even make plans for the next round or to celebrate or anything. It's heartbreaking, but honestly, it's the same old, same old, so maybe it doesn't hurt as much.
Well, I hope not. And yes, I remember well. I was in high school, and it was still the original six, and the Bruins were always in last place. They always finished sixth. Mm-hmm. It was inevitable that Boston would be last, except on two occasions, back-to-back Saturdays. The first Saturday, they beat the Montreal Canadiens, who were the perennial Stanley Cup champions. They beat them 6-0, and everybody in Montreal thought the world had stopped. And the next Saturday, the Bruins went into Toronto and beat the Leafs 11-0. Those might have been the only two games they won that year. But now they are legitimate. Well, over the years, they've become legitimate. And like you, Greg, I thought as soon as when Toronto scored, I thought, okay, this is going to be good. They could hang on here and win 1-0. And that thought stayed in my mind for about a minute and 24 seconds.
About a minute and 24.
It's over.
And you just got to place the seeds of doubt in the other team's mind,
yep.
The fans' mind, and they shrug their shoulders and say, it's not going to be our night. We had a 3-1 lead in the series. We're sitting there making our plans for the next round and getting online and buying the next round's games on Ticketmaster, and then poof. So, I mean, look, Roy, the questions are always, what keeps the Leafs fans coming back? And I don't know. It's meant to be entertaining, and you can't argue that it wasn't entertaining. I'm sure the television numbers will be incredible. Saturday night, it was the only game on, 8 o'clock start. It's a little more convenient for your West Coast audience, but it just feels like the same torture chamber you go into every April the last 8 years.
You know, if it weren't such a sadly repeating story, if their frustration hadn't built up over 58 years, if there were hockey fans under the age of 63 who could remember the Leafs winning a Stanley Cup, maybe this series would have been reasonably acceptable. They could have been gone. The Leafs could have been gone after 5, but they won that game, and then they won game 6, and they were close to surviving game 7 and sending the Bruins players to the golf course. That game could have gone either way. But it's the cumulative weight of despair and distress. I looked at the faces of fans who were on the TV screen after the game ended, and it was palatable. You know, I felt sorry for them.
Yeah,
I still do.
There's an era right now of younger fans that you see at Maple Leaf Square who are 22, 25. So they only maybe 20 years old to 30. We're not seeing 45 year olds out there wearing jerseys. It wasn't that cold last night, but we're not seeing them packed in like sardines. So these are younger fans. They only know this group. They're even too young for the Matt Sundin, Gary Roberts, Curtis Joseph here. They're barely born then, if they were. And then you've got another era that doesn't even, like, I barely was alive for the Daryl Sittler, Lanny McDonald, Boris Salmon era. So we've had these sort of runs of 5-6 years at a time, and you think, surely the law of averages says in 56 years. And Roy, this is not a team that's gone to Stanley Cup Finals and hasn't converted. They haven't even been. Like a lot of people would say, I could die happy if they just played the Stanley Cup Final game and I had a ticket to it. You might even see the opposing team win on the Leafs' home ice, but you don't even get that far. And they obviously haven't been to the semifinals in 23 years and counting now. So, and yet the ticket prices are the highest, the demand is the highest, the ratings are the highest. There's 124 sports teams in the four major sports across North America, and I think they're the most bulletproof organization. They don't have to do much to keep the money pump flowing.
So what now? What do they do to change the narrative?
They're committed to Austin Matthews. They're committed to William Nylander, and you should want that. Those are young guys, 26, 27 years old, coming into the prime of their career. I think you have to just let – I really think you're going to see the four forwards, Roy, come back. I don't think you've got value to give away Mitch Marner, knowing he'll be an unrestricted free agent at the end of the year. John Tavares, you can't trade an $11 million player who's going to be 35 at the end of next season, whose skills are diminishing. Your skills are supposed to diminish when you turn 35. And that's the thing, Roy. This is not a young team. It's not. They're the 10th oldest team in hockey this year. They got a couple kids like Matthew Nyes, who's great. They obviously have something in Joseph Woll, the goalie. Like, look at the odds of that. What are the odds your goalie in a game 7 practice, who was brilliant in a game 7 pregame skate, gets injured after being — it wasn't the backup goalie's fault. But just think of that presence and that oomph that gives you. And you just think, this is the same old stuff again if you're these players. So I assume the coach is gone. I think it might be very difficult for Brendan Shanahan to remain. There's a new boss at MLSE. His name is Keith Pelley. He does not suffer mediocrity very easily. There could be a lot of change over the next few days.
I'm going to be taking some phone calls, Greg, from our listeners after you and I speak. But let me just also bring into the discussion the fact that there are still two Canadian teams in the running for the Cup. Unfortunately, they're playing each other now, or will be, the Canucks and the Oilers. Which team do you like, and do you believe that either team has a better chance than the other of walking away with the big prize, or skating away with the big prize?
Yeah, I think there's something with Edmonton, right? They're knocking on the door. They've got two of the best, I think, five or six players in hockey in Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. They've won rounds the last 3 years. I'm not saying the Canucks are happy to be here. They finally, you know, won a round, but this is not the mania that the Canucks had with the Sedins and Luongo and whatnot when they made their cup run in 2011. So it just feels like Edmonton is a lot. Vancouver's just arrived at the door. Edmonton's been pounding on it. It doesn't mean you get through. I mean, we're just talking about these Leafs teams that can't penetrate and get and burst through the door to get to the final. So I like Edmonton, but it's going to be a fun series. The great part is, I'm sure, as you know with politics, I'm sure the fans in British Columbia and fans in Alberta will be very respectful to each other over the course of the night. That's going to be the most fun, Roy. A lot of late night emails being sent back and forth there from listeners at that.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'm a Habs fan, right? You said earlier, you don't even have the history of going to the finals in 2021. My team made it to the finals, weirdly enough, because they were the last I expected of the playoff qualifiers to make it, but they did. And then, just for you, we have this, Greg.
And it's Carbonell now bringing the puck Montreal in. Goal. Carbonell's pass to Bernabeu's goal. Carbonell pass went in front of the net, and now it is 3-0. And the crowd at the Forum in Montreal watching this game tonight are delirious.
So I love that. I love that that audio.
You can take me back. I'm a little kid. I'm waiting for Roger Doucette to come out and blast
oh,
the
good
national
Lord.
Anthem and his tuxedo.
Yeah. And Guy Carbonneau is such a good guy. You know, he comes on the show whenever we ask, and a real gentleman. Greg Brady, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I always learn a great deal about sports when I talk to you. Thank you, Greg.
All right. Pleasure's mine. Thanks for letting me on.
The boycott Loblaws effort is underway. And from what I understand, not much is being affected. Galen Weston's fortune, according to Sylvain Charlebois's column in the Toronto Sun, has gone up some $500 million as the shares of Loblaw have climbed $7 in the last little while. And Sylvain, who will be joining us later on this half hour, writes in his column, Loblaw, along with Walmart, plays a significant role in the challenges facing food manufacturing and independent grocers. Not only is food manufacturing undercapitalized, but independent grocers are also suffering under the dominance of a few large corporations that control 80% of Canada's food retail market. The reality that Canadians are spending less at grocery stores is impacting manufacturing and independent grocers more than major retailers like Loblaws. So let's talk about this grocery issue. And let's talk about independent grocers and who they are and how they contribute to the well-being of Canadians. And we've talked about this before. We've said, you know, the independent grocer is the person who lives in your community, operates the stores in your community, sponsors the Little League baseball teams and the hockey teams, and is there when you want to reach them. It's not a corporate infrastructure that, God help you, if you try to get to the corner office online, they tell you to go online, and when you get online, they tell you to go somewhere else, where it's usually quite hot and inhospitable. Anyway, let's talk. Tom's looking at me like, what the hell is he talking? That's exactly what I was talking about. Gary Sands joins us. Gary is the vice president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers. How are you, Gary?
I'm doing fine, recovering from the Leafs last night, but I'm doing fine.
Well, that's a long recovery. It's been, one of my listeners sent me an email. I talked about this a little earlier, said the Leafs are in their 58th straight year of rebuilding.
Yeah. So I've got a picture of a Pioneer wagon train going through Toronto, and somebody posted it on the web the other day saying this is the last known Stanley Cup Leaf Parade.
I feel for Leafs fans. I don't really care that much because I'm a Habs fan. And even though they didn't make the playoffs, this team is coming back. They're young. They're strong. They have a great future. The Leafs, they have a lot of questions to answer. We'll get into that next hour with Greg Rady from AM 640. Now, Gary, when it comes to the issue of independent grocers and the challenges faced by independent grocers and the consumers who are saying, I can't afford to buy my groceries anymore. I just don't have the money. What are the greatest challenges that independent grocers in Canada face servicing their customers and their communities at this time?
One of the biggest challenges is what you alluded to a bit before, and probably Sylvain Charlebois will talk about this later, but it's in Canada we have allowed, successive governments have allowed, the grocery industry, the retail grocery industry, to become overly consolidated. And it's, you know, when five companies control 80% of the channel, that's not healthy for the country. But just to explain this to your listeners, you have to understand there's hundreds, and depending on the size of the store, thousands of products in a grocery store. People should not think that, you know, hundreds and thousands of trucks are driving to grocery stores across Canada to deliver all those products. They have to go through wholesalers and distributors. So consolidation hasn't just taken place in Canada at the retail level. It's also permeated down to the wholesale and distribution levels. And in Ontario, for example, Canada's biggest province, 59% of the grocery stores in this province are independents, but the two biggest wholesalers are Loblaws and Sobeys. So not only your retail, so in many cases an independent is going to be buying from his or her retail competitor. That's a situation that is just should not have been allowed to occur, but that's a significant challenge. And we saw during COVID, for example, Roy, when there were products in short supply or high demand, where the chains would demand extra product from the manufacturers, or as we call them, the suppliers, and they would penalize them if they didn't divert product away from the independents to their stores. And again, that's one of the challenges we face, that kind of dominance in the marketplace, both at the retail level and the wholesale and distribution level, is a significant challenge for independent grocers.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about how the independent grocer addresses the issue of pricing food, how that's managed by independent grocers. But I think you just essentially told me that if you have to go and buy the product, if the independent grocer has to go and buy the product from the large chains, they can pretty well control what the independent grocer has to ask for the product.
Well, yes, and a lot of it does have to do pricing. There are a myriad of price increases that are about to hit consumers, I can tell you, in the next few weeks that our members have received notices of from the suppliers. That has nothing to do with the retail chains. Those are coming forward. I don't point my fingers at those companies either. I know there's a lot of factors driving up those prices, but we don't have the leverage to be able to push back. So an independent grocer has to really run a lean operation and look for other things to do in their business model to be able to remain price competitive, which they are. But again, there's things they have to do that it makes it very daunting to become an independent grocer in this country, and we have 6,900 of them. Back to your original question or point you were mentioning, Roy, what's the importance of independent grocers? Aside from providing, you know, healthy competition to those chains, we have to remember independent grocers are in a myriad of communities in this country, rural, remote, servicing also indigenous communities where there is no chain. And if those independent grocers aren't there, where do the people in those communities get their food? And that's why, you know, when I hear government talking about luring another foreign chain into Canada, you know, it makes what hair I have left stand on edge, because that's not what we should be talking about in Canada. We don't need another foreign chain. What the government should be doing is seeing what can we do to support the Canadian independent grocers that we have here now.
Yeah, I was about to ask you about that. Federal government wants to bring foreign retail grocery chains into Canada, arguing such an entry would create more pricing competition. And that doesn't make any sense to me at all. That makes as much sense as raising the capital gains.
It makes no sense. I don't know. First of all, it's not going to happen. You can take it from me. Having another chain come into the Canadian market when it's so consolidated, and we have such a diverse country, and the supply chain is so interconnected, interdependent, it would take years before another foreign retail chain were able to get any you know, legs in the marketplace. But how that's going to increase or help competition is beyond me. Helping Main Street grocers in Canada that are already here, that's what we should be focused on.
In his most recent column in the Toronto Sun, Sylvain Charlebois, a Dalhousie University professor and director of the Agri-Foods Lab, the headline of the column is Loblaw Boycott, a Waste of Time, but Grocer Still a Basket Case. And I understand that people are frustrated and it's difficult to put food on the table. We've talked about that at great length on this program with many experts, many people who can explain to us what's going on with the finances, what's going on with the cost of food. But the reality is, when you get to the grocery store, you can only afford what you can afford. I was horrified the other day. Well, maybe that's a strong word. I was disturbed the other day when I went to buy a head of romaine lettuce and it was $5. I was looking inside for the golden egg, but there was nothing there. Sylvain Charlebois, Professor Charlebois, is with us on The Roy Green Show. Sylvain, thank you as always. We disturb you each weekend, and we're not about to stop.
Listen, Roy, it's a pleasure to join you on weekends. I have nothing else to do, so there you go.
Okay.
You're just good. Waiting for your phone call.
And I didn't disappoint you. Okay. So let's talk about this this movement to boycott Loblaws. It's not hurting Loblaws. It's not hurting Gill and Weston. He's making massive amounts of money. The company is doing extremely well. So what's the takeaway? I mean, or where do we begin the debate about any effectiveness of any boycott?
Yeah, so let's talk about this week's performance of Loblaw. So Loblaw did report on Wednesday, new quarterly results. So as you said, numbers were really strong for Loblaw. And so gross margins are still stable. Same store food sales were at 3.4%, more than last year. That's about on par with food inflation. So again, for people who think that Loblaw is gouging consumers with food sales, there's just no evidence of that. But did you look at Loblaw's share price?
I did. I saw it in your column.
Oh my God. It's almost at $154, a record high. Which, the irony here, Roy, is that since the start of the boycott on May 1st, Gill and Weston is now $540 million richer. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what do you say? What do you say after you've said that?
Yeah, I know. But here's the thing, though. Mr. Weston also blamed the boycott for being unfairly targeted by the group. And I do have some concerns about that comment. So is Loblaw unfairly targeted for the boycott itself? Maybe. But is Loblaw unfairly targeted as being a problem in the food industry? Not a chance. Loblaw is part of the problem. I mean, there are some issues in the grocery industry, and Loblaw is very much at the center of some of these challenges. For example, we're all spending less. We're very careful with our budget. We're going to independence. We're going to the dollar store to survive. So Loblaw is adjusting its pricing strategy by putting more pressure on manufacturers. They're raising fees. And we talked about this before, Roy, on your show. Grocers get a lot of money from manufacturers to get products. So you pay your customer in the food business. And a lot of people don't know that. So Loblaw has a lot of power up the food chain. And it is using its power to protect margins. That really where the problem is. And again, I think I spoke to you about this last week. I just wish the boycott people would actually point to that problem, that supply chain bullying going on, led mainly by Loblaw and Walmart, which is essentially pushing prices higher eventually because, well, manufacturers are adjusting prices. So that cat and mouse game up the food chain is just putting more pressure on food prices, bringing more volatility, and consumers tend to be affected by that.
So for the average consumer, and I said earlier, I'm not going to participate in any boycott. I go to the grocery store, I get what I need, I stand and stare at the cash register, and then I stare at it some more, and then I leave after I've paid. But for the person who feels they'd like to do something, these boycotts don't do anything, do they?
People have the right to do whatever they want.
Oh, of course.
If they want to boycott a company, that's their business. But again, I think we spoke about this last week. When I actually look at how the boycott is structured, it has no logic. I mean, if you understand the food industry really well, and if you absolutely want to boycott a company to send out a message, you shouldn't be just boycotting Loblaw. You should be boycotting at least Loblaw and Walmart and perhaps other big box stores. Mm-hmm. And I know you had Gary Sands on before me, and Gary Sands represents independent grocers. And let me tell you, independent grocers don't get the credit they deserve in this country. And so if there is something going on last year or so, is that independent grocers are starting to get more business because people are starting to look around. We're becoming smarter. We're becoming smarter grocery shoppers,
okay,
which is a good thing.
So thank you so much, Sylvain. And expect to hear from me again next weekend.
All right. Take care, Roy.
More on the university's occupations as they continue in this country. McGill, the University of Ottawa, the University of Toronto, UBC. They're all facing demonstrations, encampments, various activities. New ones scheduled for the next coming days at the University of Manitoba. So how does this fit? And how does one of this country's most prominent academics interpret what's going on? What is behind these protests and how to view the rising anti-Semitism? By the way, at Columbia, when the police went in and closed down the protest, one of the professors who was there said he was horrified the police would do that. Another professor said he felt his heart break. Well, how does that feel? Not quite sure how that would feel under those circumstances. Professor Ken Coates joins us, professor emeritus at the University of Saskatchewan, now at Yukon University, where he's chair of Indigenous Governance Program, also a consultant to Indigenous groups and governments in this country, in New Zealand and Australia, as well as the United Nations. And Professor Coates' books include From Treaty Peoples to Treaty Nation. Professor Coates has been very good to us with his time over the years. Ken, thank you very much for coming back on the program.
It's always my pleasure.
How do you view, just an overall first, and then I'd like to get into some specifics of your sense of what's going on at the university campuses and college campuses in North America. How do you, just in an overview sense, view what's going on?
So in a very general way, outside the campuses, I'm absolutely mortified at the way we've modernized and tolerated anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is one of the worst scourges of the 20th century. It was back way before then. We've seen the horrors that have conducted under the guise of anti-Semitism. And the fact that it sort of get almost normalized in the last couple of years has been mortifying in the extreme. And I just always worry about how our Jewish friends and neighbors sort of react to the near silence of most Canadians about the anti-Semitism. It's just not acceptable. So there's lots of reasons to protest. We can talk about that in a second. University campuses are always cauldrons of protest movements. That's nothing normal, nothing unusual. But the rise of hate speech and real anger and anti-Semitism is simply intolerable.
Were you aware of that on university campuses? You teach at several. You've been to many. Have you seen an increase in anti-Semitism at university campuses over the last number of years?
Well, we've seen an increase in two things. They're related, but not exactly the same. In terms of anti-Israeli feeling, that's been quite strong for a long time. And you see this particularly in Southern Ontario and Quebec. It shows up in a much more mild form in other sorts of other jurisdictions. Outright anti-Semitism, again, Southern Ontario, you've seen outbreaks of this, you know, sort of speeches that should have been shut down, speakers who should not have been allowed to speak on campus, that kind of thing. Relatively rare instances. These are not something that happened every day. I can assure most people that the vast majority of classes are not infected by this kind of hatred and not infected by this kind of intolerance. It shows up once in a while in a few classes and a few protests, but it's still a very small movement within the university community as a whole.
So why? Why is it as virulent as it is now? Is it because of professors and instructors and their approach to the issue with the students? What's causing this?
Well, two things, and many things more, but let me highlight two things. One is that among the professors and among the more active students, there is a really strong sort of history of anti-colonial feeling, an attempt to sort of get rid of and attack organizations and governments that are sort of pushing back against minority populations as they're perceived. And so we see that on Indigenous rights, we see it on anti-colonial movements and everywhere in the world. And so that shows up on campus, and it shows up with some professors who see the world that way and understand it in that way. We also have a much larger number of Muslim students in Canada than we used to have. The very rapid growth of immigration into this country, 1 million people last year, has brought in hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people from Muslim countries, the vast majority of them fitting in extremely well, making great contributions in the university and to their chosen professions. But many of them, not surprisingly, bring the sort of radical elements that exist in the Middle East, in certain countries in the Middle East and in South Asia. And those people now have a constituency. You know, in Saskatchewan, you might have had a couple of dozen people from South Asia and the Middle East 20 years ago, and now you've got hundreds of them. And so when you have those, you've got a sort of a more fertile ground, I guess, to sort of seed some of the revolutionary talk. Most of the Muslim students are not engaged in these kinds of protests. Most of the students in the Middle East are here to learn and find an opportunity in Canada. Most of them are not engaged in hate speech and anti-Semitism, but there are enough to actually make it into a bit of a national movement.
So as I look at what's going on, and particularly I watched Columbia and UCLA over the last week in the United States, we're seeing the University of Toronto, McGill University as well, UBC. Some of the tactics remind me somewhat, and I was a very young man at the time these things happened in the late 60s at universities, particularly in the United States. There were protests and there were demonstrations and there was violence. Is there any relationship between what happened in the 60s and what's happening now?
Well, there is one. I'm glad you brought it up, right? It's a really important point. Universities from the 1960s on have been sort of seedbeds for protest. And I must tell you, that's actually a really good thing. That if you look at the emergence of Indigenous rights, of women's rights, of minority rights generally, anti-war protests in the 1960s, these are very, very prominent on university campuses. And in fact, anti-war protests have started on the campuses, spread across America, and very much led to the American withdrawal and the sort of the giving up and the attempt to sort of keep the fighting going in Vietnam. So young people on university campuses have demonstrated their capacity to change public policy and to change the way people view the world. And so in one sense, that's a really good thing. We have to have some place where there's outlet for protest and anger and frustration. Universities have young people who are idealistic. We often see the world in fairly simplistic terms, and they push for change. And good on them. I mean, quite frankly, if we were having this conversation 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said that one of the biggest problems at universities were they weren't active enough, and universities were too complacent. They were too focused on careers, and people weren't engaged with the world. Well, guess what? They turned around. Now they're engaged. They're demanding all sorts of big and radical, dramatic changes. And so in one sense, it's a real straight continuity between the 1960s and now. The difference, however, is that what we're seeing now is much more organized protests. These things are not entirely spontaneous. It's not as though a group of 5 students at the University of Toronto decided to organize an encampment. There are people behind these protests, as there are environmental groups doing exactly the same thing. They organize these events. They try to raise the profile. They get people involved in encampments. I'm particularly troubled by the encampment process, where people figure they can just get onto a campus, take over a bunch of physical space, intimidate the heck out of any Jewish people who are there, students, faculty, or staff, and basically assert their right over the managers of the space, the universities, and the other people who use it. So I think we've also, in Canada, become very complacent with those kind of protests. So if you look at New Caledonia, it lasted for a decade or longer, the indigenous protests there. We've gotten tolerant of very, very long protests and encampments, and I think our cities are really paying the price for that. Quite frankly, they don't have much impact anymore. We've had so many of these encampment things now that nobody's quite sure what it's for.
Ken, when it comes to the administrations of the universities, are you at all satisfied with the way they've handled the situation? And then let's just move forward with what we've seen and how that impacts on Jewish communities in this country and in the United States. It has to be terrifying.
I think if we talk quickly about the Jewish situation, it is absolutely terrifying. The words are filled with hate and spite, not by everyone, not all the time, but there are enough of those bad words to sort of just terrify the heck out of Jewish people, and nowhere near enough words countering that from non-Jewish people. It's incumbent upon the rest of us to stand up and make it clear we find this intolerable, and we don't do that enough.
Yeah.
We leave it to Jewish people to defend themselves. I'm sorry, it's our collective responsibility, not just the Jewish folks, to do that, which they do very, very well. In terms of the university administrations, I've worked with many of the people who are in these situations right now. The principal of McGill University is a close friend, and he's addressing a huge problem. The short answer would be, those picking any individual campuses, is they have not, as universities, done very well with the question of controlling speech. They've overreacted on certain issues, stopping people from the right, for example, from having a forum on campus because they're protest against them. And they've been too acquiescent when people who are opposed to Israel and the Jewish folks in letting them then get away with some of their talks and conversations. So we've got a real battle over speech on university campuses, which we haven't really reconciled yet. And university administrations are sometimes waiting for directions from government. Ontario's trying to give directions. Alberta's certainly trying to give directions. But I think we need to recognize that universities are places where ideas will boil over from time to time. But when they get to the point of real hatred, they have to stop. And the universities must pull out all efforts to sort of control it. I don't really like encampments. Encampments are often sort of filled with people who come there for a whole variety of reasons. They're just protesting for the sake of protesting. And you get very earnest, honest individuals who are very angry about what's going on in Gaza, as they have every right to be, who are then mixed up with people who are just sort of more anarchistic in nature, and they just like protests. And so I think having these things show up on our campuses just sullies the whole enterprise. Those aren't speech. They're nothing to do with speech. Speech is about meetings. Speech is about talks. It's about conversations. It isn't about tents.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk about professional agitators being involved who will travel from one protest to another, and that the funding is coming from somewhere, and the funding is not inconsiderable. So the motivation behind all of this becomes more questioned than just the position that, we're challenging Israel for its behavior toward Gaza. The question is, what's the main feature of the protest, and who are these people who are leading it? Because I've heard time and again, the majority of people at these encampments are not university students at all.
Exactly. And they are people who are sometimes professional agitators or just very naive people who haven't thought through the issues particularly seriously. And social media, of course, takes very complicated issues and boils it down into sort of little memes and little short comments. There's no question that the broader issue is the survival of Israel. And I'm not supporting the government of Israel. They've done some things in this war that are quite unacceptable. But Israel as a state deserves to survive. It has a right to survive, to exist as a nation state. Other people just hate that idea. People who are just opposed to the very idea of the Jewish state. And deeper than that, there are people who are brought to the ugly, ugly head, the deep specter of anti-Semitism, which we've seen so many times through our history. It's a deep history in Canada. We've had strong anti-Jewish regulations. Jewish people were not, they had quotas on Jewish people going into, you know, universities in the 1960s. Particularly into medicine and law and places like that. You know, so anti-Semitism is one of these, it's like a disease that sits in the background and sparks up every once in a while. So we'd better push this one back and make it clear that Jewish folks are completely welcome in our country and a part, huge part of our Canadian fabric. And I just cannot tolerate any effort that sort of is designed as hatred toward Jews or animosity toward Israel as a nation state, not toward a government, not toward the actions of the Netanyahu regime, but toward the idea of Israel as a nation state. We got way past that. We have to be a bit better. We have to be stronger.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.